Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO. It's a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, driving gear, and most certainly watches. This is episode 387, and it's proudly brought to you by the always growing TGN supporter crew. We thank you all so much for your continued support, and if you're listening and would like to support the show, please visit thegreynato.com for more details. My name is James Stacey, and I'm joined as ever by my friend and co-host, Jason Heaton. Jason, how are we doing today? Hitting mid-August pretty hard. Just back from vacation.
Yeah, it's wild. Geez, 18th of August. I hate to you know, even utter the word autumn, but it's been that changing light and a couple of trees starting to turn color. It's looking forward to getting back in a sweater at some point and a pair of boots. But other than that, I'm really still leaning into summer pretty hard here. Went for a swim last night at the lake. I don't have to do that training anymore for that long swim. I can just do it for fun, and it was just kind of a nice outing to ride my bike down to the lake nearby here and just go for a swim just for fun. It was great.
That's so great.
Hopefully a few more weeks of that.
Yeah, I'm hoping so. Like I said, I'm back at work after 2 weeks away from Hodinkee, and we're already, you know, Sarah and I were walking to drop our son off at daycare this morning and said, when do you want to go to the cottage? Like how soon can we make it up there? Kind of starting this weekend, you enter the last phase. Apologies if you could hear that cicada. We'll make a quick audio cut as I had my window open, and I could definitely hear.
Right on cue for summer
exactly,
chat.
For sure, yeah. But yeah, we just enter that phase where it's kind of, you know, you're into that last season of the summer. You know, we usually pack up the cottage by mid-October, but I've got tons of travel between now and then. We've got the Toronto Timepiece Show. So it's not a lot of free weekends. It's not as easy to just commit to like every weekend we're going to be up there pretty much.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, but definitely still good swimming season. Still good, sipping a beer on the sand, time of year, and still a couple of projects left to do up there before the end of the season, ideally. So we'll probably get up this weekend and get some of the tools out and make a few modifications to the property. But that's about all I've got, on my list. But I did mention the Toronto Timepiece Show,
yeah,
which also includes our annual marathon party. And that's coming up. That'll be the 26th, 27th of September. Anybody listening is well aware. The marathon party will be the evening of the 26th. All are welcome, of course. There will be an RSVP in the future. We'll send one out probably towards the end of this month, very early September, with all of the details. And if you RSVP and you get in, then we're excited to see you there. And yeah, the show should be great. We're planning sort of some stuff to do on Saturday, which will include a live show, which we've done the last couple of years from the sort of event space that's right next. It's in the same building. So you literally just walk into some doors that are next to one of the brands that are exhibiting, and you're able to kind of enjoy a live show. We're always excited to do those, and they're a good time. And then I'm working on plans for a couple of other things as well, which should be fun as those come together. But if you're planning to be in town, I know there's lots of organizing and otherwise going on in the TGN Slack as far as how people are approaching the show and recommendations. And this is sort of you're not quite downtown and you're not quite out of Toronto. It's this sort of midtown area, which has lots of options for, you know, places to stay and places to eat and all that kind of stuff. So should be a good one. We're awfully excited for that. And then another just sort of news that we finally can share. Some time ago, a couple months back, we announced to the Slack a TGN sort of dazzle camo TGN 10th anniversary nylon NATO style strap with our friends at Strap Habit. And they immediately sold out. Immediately. They went so quickly, it was kind of insane. And we had added so many more to the number than we thought we would need. So after that initial sellout, they've now been resupplied, and you can find the link in the show notes to those. It's that kind of bright orange and tan NATO pattern that we've been using since the boxes for the CW and one, but then rendered into either a 20 or 22 millimeter nylon strap. This is a double pass, so you can remove the keeper if you don't need it, the underkeeper, and you have the option of either like silver tone or black tone hardware. So I'm really thrilled with this. It's actually what I have on my wrist, which takes us into a bit of wrist check. Jason, before we jump into your watch, which I guess could be wearing one of these straps, have you had a chance to wear these much? I'm not usually a big fan of, like, I wore the lizard camo from Kill Hubris for years. I still do.
Oh, yeah.
And I absolutely adore it. But it's a very rare thing that where they really hit the mark. And I'm really happy with this strap. I mean, obviously, I'm hugely biased, but I think it turned out really nicely. Stay Calm Industries helped us with the design. And if you flip it over, there's a little Easter egg built into the camo pattern, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think these are great. I do wear mine more than I thought I would. Like you, I'm just not much of a patterned strap person, short of, you know, like an Erica's with a single stripe down the middle or whatever. But I don't know. There's just something about the way that the camo is designed, the way it kind of hits on the sides of the wrist that doesn't seem too egregiously kind of busy or anything like that. And, you know, I don't know if it's a great winter strap, but it's just kind of hitting perfectly for summer, you know, with just like a t-shirt yeah. and a big dive watch or something.
So for wrist check this week, what have you got on?
I do have the FXD, so I'm not wearing it on the TGN10 strap. I've just got it on, actually, I've got it on a Watches of Espionage NATO today. But yeah, it's not much to say about this watch. We've talked about it so much, but a little anecdote. I was at the, there's a neighborhood farmer's market every Sunday nearby here, and I was over there, and there's a guy who offers knife sharpening services while you kind of shop for vegetables at the other stands. And we left a few knives with him, kitchen knives to sharpen. And when I went to pick them up later, the young guy, you know, pretty young, kind of early 20s kid who was kind of manning the booth, kind of taking the money and talking to customers, he had this kind of funky old watch on. And I kind of asked him if I could see it. And he held it up, and it was like this 19, looked like a 40s Bulova or something. And asked if I could take a picture of it. And lo and behold, on his water bottle, he had like an Audubon Society sticker on it. And I said, "Have you seen Lister's?" And he said, "I've seen it like three times, once with my bird group." And I just watched it last week, actually, which was a lot of fun. I forgot to mention it on last week's show, but so great. And so we kind of bonded over that. And then I was wearing my FXD. This is getting around to my story here, but he said, "Oh, nice Tudor." And I was like, "Yeah, you know, some cool kind of in the wild watch nerd recognition back and forth." So it was kind of fun.
That's great. Yeah, absolutely. Super, super fun. And I mean, a great watch. And I had my, my Pelagos 39 on recently with that Tudor video finally coming out for Hodinkee. My feelings about those watches and the, like, especially stuff from the Pelagos world,
yeah,
really hasn't changed in a very long time. I'm just a big fan. Even the stuff that's maybe a little bit big for my wrist.
Mm-hmm.
I really like them all the way up to and including the Ultra, which I think is quite a cool watch.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I've handled one in person yet, but yeah, that's got to change. Yeah. Oh, and one other thing, I guess this isn't really wrist check, but I never mentioned this, but when we record, I have this, I don't know, let's see what the year does it say on the back here. It's from 92. It's a CWC stopwatch that I keep on my desk, issued in 1992, cool. And it's got the Broad Arrow mark on the back and the Royal Navy markings. And I always time our episodes. It's just a fun thing to do. I just click to start the stopwatch when we start recording, and it ticks away on my desk here. So that's sort of wrist check adjacent.
Yeah, absolutely. That's rad. We'll have to see if we can include a photo of that in there. They certainly make some very cool ones in their past, including some which have shown up in movies and things like that.
Yeah.
We've talked about it. But for me this week, I'm wearing my CWN1 on the Strap Habit TGN10 strap. The Dazzle Camo strap that I already spoke about. And I've been wearing this for the last couple of days. I've spent the last several weeks, I guess. Yeah, but nearly several weeks of just wearing the Doxa and nothing else.
Yeah.
The Army 200T that we did with Doxa at Hodinkee. I absolutely adore it. And for whatever reason, yesterday I was like, I wanted the quartz, or I wanted maybe a set. I don't remember, but I just instantly just grabbed this. It was sitting on my desk and running and already on the TGN10 strap. So that's what I'm wearing with the Strap Habit strap. And I like it.
Oh,
it's nice. It's a great combo. It feels weirdly large after wearing the Doxa for the better part of 3 weeks or whatever, a month. It of course, isn't an especially large watch, but it also weighs nothing. It's just so comfortable.
Yeah.
Especially if you've got a strap where the sizing really, really kind of works out, which it does for me on these ones. So definitely good stuff.
Yeah, good combo for sure. All right, we got a fun episode.
It's kind of a fun one. We were, you know, this August, it's always tough for us to be like, what are we even going to talk about? You know, we're 2 weeks or so away from Geneva Watch Days, where there, I'm sure, will be some interesting and fun watches announced. There's some bigger stuff being announced next week, which I'm sure we can talk about on next week's episode. But beyond that, we're kind of searching for a topic. This is also not a time of year where Jason and I are like doing a lot of activities that are like, I'm outside, I'm doing stuff, but I'm like, you know, I might be building an outdoor shower or something. And we're not going to devote an episode to that or going on a hike or tuning up my bike or something like that. It just isn't that interesting. Yeah. All things considered. So we dug back into the Q&A questions, and we actually found one from Dave Ann, who's kind of posing us offering up a three-watch collection of watches that are good watches, but we don't like them.
Yeah.
Which is a kind of a fun premise and one that I kind of liked. And we've taken Dave's suggestion, and thank you very much for that, Dave, and we've twisted it a little bit where it's going to be a draft. So Jason and I will be drafting watches, and we will each pick three fairly specific watches, like a model, a known model. But to finish it out, there'll be a fourth pick, which is going to be an entire category of watches that we don't like. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just, you know, this is going to be the most deeply subjective episode of things like, I don't care for X, and this is why, is kind of the idea, despite the fact that I think almost everything on my list would be considered like an icon of some sort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which is kind of a fun place to start. So, Jason, I think that's about as well sorted as we need. And neither of us can pick any that the other picks. They are blind picks, so I don't know what you've selected. We didn't put them in the show notes or that sort of thing. And so once something is picked, like I said, when we were planning this, if you pick the Timex Iron Man
mm-hmm.
As a hypothetical watch that people like but you don't, I can't go ahead and also pick that.
Yeah.
So with that all being said, I don't remember which one of us had first pick in a draft previously.
Well, I would say you go first. I feel like I always go first because you usually do the intro and then you hand it over to me. So I think in this case, why don't you run with it?
Okay, let's see. That gives me so much freedom. And I guess with it just being two of us, it doesn't have to be serpentine. It's just back and forth for our four picks.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with a classic. And I to be clear, the other thing, and I don't know about your picks, Jason, so this is not a statement anyway. I tried to stick to watches that I could or would buy.
Okay.
So like, it's not that interesting for me to say like, oh, I don't like the Nautilus.
Mm-hmm.
Well, James, you're never going to get a Nautilus.
Yeah. Yeah.
So your opinion of it's probably not necessarily all that valuable. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm going to try and stick with things that are like within the realm of my actual reality thereabouts. So there'll be some wiggle room in that space. But my first one is, I think, an absolutely fantastic watch. But one that no matter how many I have bought and owned, it never works on my wrist.
Mm.
And that's a G-Shock 5600.
Oh, wow.
That's okay. your standard core, arguably a perfect unit of digital watch.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never found one that I liked. I've had the, you know, the red frame Atomic. I've had the cheap one. I've had like the M&M white one back, you know, 15, 20 years ago. And none of them really land for me. And it's weird because sometimes you go like, oh, maybe their stuff is too big. I like the Iron Man 8 lap because it's kind of small and diminutive and feels very light. They're not necessarily the same level of robustness, of course.
Yeah.
G-Shocks are just some of the toughest stuff in the world. But I think I enjoyed my Rangeman more, which is the size of two 5600s on your wrist. I used to wear a ProTrek a bunch, which is, again, a huge watch. So it's not a size thing. They literally, it's something about the way the strap integrates with the case, I think.
Huh.
And they never just, they have to be quite tight to sit flat on whatever is going on with my wrist shape.
Yeah.
Do you have any, are you plus minus on a 5600? You're not a huge digital watch guy.
I had G-Shock on my list, so I'm going to scratch that from my list, which, but I will say that of the G-Shock family, I have tried so hard to like all of them, and the only one that I would even consider is the 5600. That's not to say I'm recommending it. In fact, it G-Shock in general made my list. But you know, I really thought it would be, you know, given my predilection for diving, I thought, oh, the Frogman's the one for me. I tried a Frogman. I've tried a 5600. Yeah. I've tried, and none of them stick. You know, I might have talked about this in the past, you know, 10 years of this show that G-Shock's just not my thing, and I want so badly to like G-Shocks, but the 5600 is the most tame one, and I think that's why,
yeah,
of all the G-Shocks, that would be the only one that I could see putting on my wrist, just because it doesn't have such whiz-bang graphics or the big bulbous case and whatever.
Sure. Yeah, the other thing is they are just really cool watches.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I watched Speed with my daughters last night, and of course, Keanu Reeves' character, that's what he's wearing. And by the end, you know, they've slid out from under the bus. Spoilers, I guess, for this movie from 1994 that all of you should have seen. But they, you know, they exit the scary part of the movie, and he's kind of got Sandra Bullock in his arms, and you get like a really clean shot of this watch. It's all covered in mud and dirt and debris, and you just, nice. Man, that looks really good.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, there's several G-Shocks throughout the Mission Impossible series. It's never really worked for me. I remember using my Rangeman more like a true tool watch. If I was going hiking, that sort of thing, I would wear it and use it. And I really liked it. It was quite useful. And then once the world of like the Suntos and then the Garmins really came online,
yeah,
not to be unfair to G-Shock, like they still make a fantastic watch and they're probably much more stylish than a Garmin. But I just wear the Garmin if that's what I'm going for.
Yeah.
The function, the fit, the weight. Again, a conventional lug with a conventional strap option versus the sort of resin of everything. You know, it's the same reason I've never really connected with like an F91W. They're just, I don't find them to be even remotely comfortable. It's in light.
Yeah.
But there's something about the edging of the strap that I find kind of noticeable on my wrist.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's my first pick. An absolute classic. The 5600.
Yeah.
How about you? What have you got for your first one?
All right, this is a big one.
We're going to ruffle some feathers.
Ruffles. Yes, I am.
Does everybody get their pearls ready?
Yes, I am. Ruffled feathers and pearls clutched here. Rolex Explorer.
Okay.
36 or 39.
Do you have an Explorer?
I used to have a 14270. So the old 36mm tritium dial. Yeah, I sold it to TGN-er years ago. In fact, I revisited it when I was in New York last summer. The guy who bought it from me showed up at an event with my old watch on. But look, objectively, these are spectacular watches. They're such an icon. Everybody, I think, across the board loves these, except me. I wouldn't call it a hate. I don't truly strongly dislike these watches. It's just I've owned one. I've tried them. And, you know, I think I've gone on record as someone who likes gadgets with watches. I like a bezel to spin or some pushers to push. But that's not the reason I just don't really like this watch, or I can't bond with it. It's I love a 1016 Explorer, or whatever. I think it was a 6610 was the very first iteration way back in the 50s. But the difference is whenever they switched over to applied markers and applied numerals, it's not even so much the applied aspect of it, because I have a sub, you know, with applied white gold markers, and I can do it on a sub, I can do it on an Explorer 2 or a GMT Master, but for some reason those applied numerals just don't disagree with me. I just do not like those applied numerals. I find them a little bit dated now, whereas like on a 1016, those kind of looping painted on tritium markers are just so spectacular. So it's kind of the reason I like the Tudor Ranger, the current edition, and would wear that, but I would not want to wear an Explorer. So
fair.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the Explorer a lot. I've told this story so many times. Years ago, I was in Miami checking out and shooting this massive story for, all the watches that were just around at Matt Bain's office. He's this dealer in Miami and a buddy of Ben's. And he let us in and just kind of kept bringing trays out. And it was just like one wild tray after another. And one of them was like these sort of pseudo modern 5-digit Rolex stuff. And yeah, he had, I don't remember if it was a 14270, had 11427-0, but it was on a Jubilee. And I thought it was very cool. And to this day, I kind of wish I had bought it. He didn't want much money for it. It was definitely a fair price. I think they look great. You know, the other thing that would keep me from ever maybe having one now is, you know, I work very closely with Malika Crawford at Hodinkee, who runs Hodinkee Magazine. And she wears one and she just looks so much cooler than I'm ever going to look wearing it. It's so chic on her. And she really pulls it off. And it's I believe it's a 14270. On a bracelet. And I always think whenever I see that, I go, wow, I think that one's off the table for me. I can't match that. I can't match that at all. But I like those watches a lot. But yeah, I really liked the Ranger, and I like there's very little polish on the Ranger as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I definitely dig the choice of the Explorer. We'll see if I might may or may not have a Rolex on my list. I'm playing the list like jazz here. We're kind of going in different directions.
All right.
My next one will be a surprise to many, as it's a brand that I really like and one that I probably have evangelized quite extensively. And it's a watch that I think is exceptionally cool, but I don't actually like the watch.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the Breitling Emergency.
Oh, okay. The latest or all of them?
I would say at all Breitling Emergencies. There's I love seeing them.
Yeah,
it's kind of like seeing a Hummer, like a real Humvee.
Oh sure, yeah,
like one of the original, like or an H1, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
It's like seeing one of those. I go like, oh, that's fascinating that exists, that you were able to fit it into your parking space, that you drive that around town or whatever. But then every time that I experience one in the person, like put it on my wrist or have it in hand, I just think, wow, you took an aerospace and made it worse for a function that it's not provable that anybody's really used or gotten a great value out of. And to be clear, if that watch saves your life, that function is worth it for sure.
Yeah.
But I this is probably because I am such an ardent fanboy of 40 millimeter and even 42 millimeter aerospaces, but especially the early series, the 40 mil stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think, you know, at this, they're making these two watches at the same time. And one is this like sleek, gorgeous. I think it's a weird type of beauty, but I do think the aerospace is quite a cool, great looking watch. And I just, yeah, it's always kind of led me to go like, I don't understand why you would have gone emergency when the aerospace is like next to it in the cabinet or whatever.
Yeah. I can get that. I mean, I think, you know, comfort is such a huge concern with so many of these picks and just the way a watch wears. And especially like, as we're making these picks, some of these watches we've tried and passed on, you know, I mean, I can think of several, you know, old Willard Seikos or, you know, Speedmasters that I've owned. And sometimes it's just something that doesn't hit. And oftentimes it has to do with, just comfort or just kind of you're looking at it sideways. And I think it's, I kind of think this whole exercise that we're doing here today is kind of a case study for this idea that watch appeal really almost entirely comes down to an aesthetic, kind of choice. And then we kind of go ahead and justify it with other things like, you know, pedigree and movement and finishing mm-hmm. and provenance and all that kind of stuff. And I think, you know, objectively, all these watch picks that we're making today, I haven't heard all of yours, but I'm guessing that all of them are, you know, really excellent watches by most measures. And it's just really kind of comes down to like what you want to look at on your wrist or what doesn't feel quite right. And I'm a huge fan of the Emergency. And just goes to show, like, I owned one. I owned the Orbiter 3 version with the blue dial years ago. And I don't regret getting rid of that one because the Orbiter connection wasn't for me. But I still kind of look at some yellow dial or the old orange dial, the Coral, I think they called it. Dials
sure.
ones or the blue ones from back in the
90s
and that's still I'd still rock one of those. Those are great.
I also think like a lot, you know, in if we're considering how you rank the importance of various elements of a watch, like it wouldn't be Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but you know, the watch idiots hierarchy of needs, like obviously the top, you have to like the way the watch works or looks.
Mm-hmm.
You have to like the way it fits your wrist.
Mm-hmm.
And then somewhere on that list, and I'm not like embarrassed to admit this, but I'm also not sure how much it weighs in, is like, do you identify with the other types of people you see wearing that watch?
Yeah, sure.
And when it comes to the Emergency, you might be the only exception to that, because I see it on guys in Tommy Bahamas at the airport, and I see it on kind of hardcore special forces types.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I can't really identify with either of those dudes at this point. I'm kind of somewhere in the middle. You know what I mean? And yeah. I just like I think if I put one on, it would feel too posery for me.
Yeah.
And I think the aerospace is subtle enough to pull me back from that line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't lead a life of emergencies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ideally, you know.
Right.
It's a little bit too serious, maybe. I'm not sure. Maybe I'm not explaining the point. Maybe some people understand.
No, I get it. Yeah.
But I do think they are cool, but it's almost like cool in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as you start to bring in the context of like some of the other Anti-Digi from that brand, And that sort of thing. And then I go like, ah, these are a bit much, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I get that. And I, especially the current edition of the Emergency, assuming they're still making it, just got incredibly expensive and much bigger. I remember the first year it came out, I got one into review for Gear Patrol back then. And, this was separate from the one that I owned, and the newer ones are just massive, and it just became unwearable. And then the price was way beyond anything that I could afford. So I'm still a fan of the old ones. But, you know, it's funny when you said my life is not one of emergencies. I was remembering maybe the last episode or the one before when you were talking about differentiating between what's urgent and what is important. And it's and for some reason, as you were just talking, I was thinking they should make a different version of the Breitling called the Breitling Urgency.
Yeah, exactly.
Not sure what feature it would have or what functions, but anyway. That's a bit of an aside.
But yeah, so that's my second pick of my three. Jason, what have you got for your second?
All right, here's a good one. This is one we've talked about. It is the Grand Seiko UFA Spring Drive Diver, the one that just came out.
The most recent one, sure.
Yeah, the most recent one. So it's a 40 millimeter watch. It's got this highly accurate spring drive movement. It seems like they answered all of our quibbles over Grand Seiko divers. You know, it's got a good bracelet. It's got the smaller size, seemingly wears well. It's really accurate. It's nice looking. But I can't get around the, that kind of patterned dial. It's sort of has that, three-dimensional sort of textured dial. And then, I just feel like Grand Seiko always does such a, I don't want to say a poor job, but a questionable head scratching job on the dial text. It never looks as like fitting with the kind of the elegance of the watch itself. The text always looks a little boring. So again, this is a case where it's almost entirely an aesthetic thing. I mean, it's just, I just would have a hard time looking down at that and just not kind of squinting every time I see it, because it's such a spectacularly good watch that it's hard it's hard to not like. And yet I don't. And I think, you know, going along with this theme of, let's draft a watch or recommend a watch or whatever you want to say that is really an excellent piece, but that we don't like, this is a classic case of that, because it truly is a superior watch. It's just not for me.
You know, I had this watch on my like first list that I wrote yesterday, and I took it off simply because this is a $13,000 watch, which is not an amount of money I spend on watches. And when you factor that into Canadian and do taxes, we're talking about $20,000 on a Grand Seiko.
Yeah. Yeah.
For a dive watch that for me would fill the same slot as a Pelagos.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I think we said this in our episode following, like in the megasode following the show this year.
Mm-hmm.
I think we said that like it'd be cool to see this in like just a matte black dial. Like
tone it down
a level. But if it was still $13,000, that wouldn't, my credit card's not coming out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that there's some really tough competition at this price point, because you have to fight some of the stalwarts, and you're up above the price of a Submariner.
Yeah.
And you're sort, you know, now we're talking, you know, Sea Dweller ish money, and that sort of thing. And I'm not saying that it's not an incredible watch. That's absolutely not my point. Grand Seiko makes awesome watches. I'm just saying I think it's a really awkwardly positioned watch in terms of what it's offering and what it costs, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think the people that fall into the overlaps of all those things make it a bit of a niche play, and for me the price makes it would negate it from my list for today. But yeah, I don't disagree on the rest of it. I would love for them to make something, you know, dial it back a little bit.
Yeah.
Again, like we've talked in the SLA 017s, SLA 037, those were maybe a little bit more in our vibe and more in the, at least at the original price point, maybe more in our striking zone.
Yeah, yeah. And to be clear, as I'm talking about this, I think to myself, and I think you mentioned this too with like the Emergency, these are all watches so far, these four, that if I saw them across the room on somebody's wrist and some stranger, let's say was on an airplane or a dive boat, I'd be so excited. I'd be like,
oh yeah,
I'd love to see a Grand Seiko diver on somebody's wrist in the wild. I just think it'd be such a blast, and I'd celebrate that. I think it'd be great. And that's what's fun about this, I think.
Yeah, I don't disagree. That's an interesting point to bring up. If I saw a 5600 on somebody, especially if it was an interesting one, I'd probably be pretty pumped about that, or at least I wouldn't be like, well, at least it's not a whatever, insert whatever, you know, totally bland smartwatch or whatever. And if I saw an Emergency, I'd be jacked.
Yeah,
just like seeing an H1. I don't want to have one in my driveway, so to speak. Right.
Yeah, right.
All right, well, here's my third and last before we get to the entire category to pick, which might be wild. We'll see.
Yeah.
I'm struggling on this. I've got three here that I kind of dislike in all the same ways, in some ways. I'm going to go with one that it really shouldn't be a surprise if you've listened to the show for a while, because it is a great watch. It's an inarguably great watch that I just don't really like necessarily the way that it fits in the modern sense. And I don't like the hands.
Hmm.
And that might be enough of a hint that it's the Omega Seamaster 300 meter, the S&P.
Yeah.
I am an ardent fan of, you know, 2254s and sword hands. And for whatever reason, these watches, the successful continuation, maybe due to Bond, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, Bond, it's been 20 years since they went to PO. But maybe due to the Brosnan Bonds, they decided that the skeleton hands were going to be the way to go versus the sword. And I just, it's not an agreement. It's not a choice that I would, you know, and I just don't agree necessarily with that move. I really like the MOD style design language,
yeah.
What you get in the CWCs, what you get in 5517s, all this sort of stuff. As they went from 1120s into 2500s into, you know, I think it's 8000, 8900 series, like whatever the current master coaxial scenario is. They also got thicker along the way.
Oh, yeah.
And part of what made those original models, including the quartz ones, so sweet was the proportions. Sure, they were 41 millimeters wide and wore like 41, but they were thin. And the lugs turned so beautifully. And I think so much of that is preserved in the modern one. But between the thickness and the sword hands, it's a watch that there's no argument to say that this is a bad watch.
Yeah.
It's a very successful watch for them. It comes in a bajillion different colors. Everybody enjoys having one. You had a great white dial, which is probably my favorite version, maybe the Necton, hard to say.
Yeah.
Probably my favorite version of those eras, but it just doesn't, it's not something I want on my wrist as much as I would love to be a guy that has a modern Omega diver. That'd be great.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. And I think it's been one of kind of our core tenets of TGN since the beginning, was kind of our ambivalence about the Seamaster, because we both have such love for several of their watches, you know, that have been out since the 90s.
But
yeah, exactly. Yeah, they really do. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good call. I've got two, and then I've got my category, and man, I really want to talk about both of these, but I'm going to make a pick here. Let's see here. I think, you know, erring on the side of more affordability, that wasn't kind of one of our agreed upon rules, but since you've kind of set that for yourself, I think I'm going to stick to that. This almost feels sacrilege to mention, but I think I've gone on record before and we've talked about it. This is such a purely subjective aesthetic choice for people, and it's just definitely not for me. And that is any Seiko Monster diver. I get why. Well, I don't know if I truly get why people like them, because they're not. It's not like they're great watches, right? I mean, they're not like, they're great in the way that an SKX was, or, you know, something like that. Just that a true beater, something you can bang around and have fun with, and it's a good summer watch, and it's waterproof, etc. But I'm guessing they keep pretty crappy time for the most part. I'm sure some are better than others, but they just look so cheap. They just look so cartoonish, and more so even than some of the real cartoonish ones from Citizen. You know, that I've got this EcoDrive, EcoZilla, that I got back in Chicago last month and whatever. And that kind of has that same, it's in that same family, but for some reason the Monster just looks kind of cheap and kind of, you know, just like a kind of a mall watch in kind of the worst way. I'm really digging a hole here.
I love the Monster.
Yeah, I know. I realize
it's a goodie.
I should put my shovel away here before I get tarred and feathered.
But, no, please. I think that's kind of the point. And yeah, I've never known you to have been a Monster guy. Obviously, you were a 7002 SKX dude.
Yeah.
And probably still are to some extent. I think we still are. It's just my dad's got my 007.
Yeah.
And he was wearing it the other day at the cottage, and it just looked great.
Yeah.
You know, that watch is approaching 20 years. On somebody's wrist. But yeah, with the Monster, I think that's very much, what's the saying? Marmite.
Yes.
It's a love hate sort of thing. It's very distinctive. No other watch kind of looks just like it.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree. It does slot more into the realm of the wild Japanese diver, whether it's the Orient Beast or one of the Zillas or something like that. But even in that category, it feels like its own sort of scenario. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see it not being beloved by all. I certainly enjoy it, but it is it's a very specific plate of food.
Yeah, and again, if I saw one on a dive boat, somebody's wrist, I'd celebrate them. I'd be like, you know, right on, buddy, for making that choice, because it kind of shows that you're a bit of a watch nerd. Even though I said it looks like a mall watch, it's probably not the kind of watch that somebody randomly walking through a mall and saw it would buy it. It really does seem to have some weird appeal among kind of watch insider types, which is kind of fun.
The other thing that I would say is, like, there's mall watch, and then there's a different category that I'm never sure how much people will take offense to, because I don't mean it as offense, but there is there's a slice of Seiko, a slice of Citizen, heck, there's a slice of Omega and Breitling that are like duty free watches.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And like, if you see a guy like with, you know, what were those sort of Navitimer-esque Seikos? I owned one.
Oh, yeah.
An SNA 411.
Mm-hmm.
Was the black with the yellow. Great watch.
Yeah.
They also made like one in like Tommy Hilfiger colors, like blue, white, red.
Yeah, right.
And they did like a gold tone with the black.
Mm-hmm.
And those for me, I think it's because I was on a cruise as a young man getting into watches and saw them.
Yeah.
You know, I walked by the display every day and saw them. And there's always that category where like these feel like something you'd snap up on a cruise and then wear for a while. And I feel the same way about a certain type of, you know, the like Blue Angels or that variety of Citizen, which are like great watches.
Yeah.
I remember my grandfather got one on a cruise to Alaska and just wore it all the time. You know, the little nice little digital display, great watch.
Yeah, those are great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of vacation indiscretions. Feeling freewheeling and kind of loose with your money, and you've had a cocktail.
They got this nice
and you're
Seiko
like,
oh, down yeah, there. It's yeah, got right. all these features.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe you win something at the casino.
Yeah.
You know, it's not real money yet until you get back to the shore. We
exactly.
all know that.
Right, right.
But yeah, so that's our original six total.
Yeah.
A big spread here. We got some G-Shocks, some Seiko, Rolex, Breitling, Omega.
Yeah.
Definitely some stuff that's beloved. But this, I don't know if this next part is where, you know, we'll get people more riled up. I'm not sure. And to be honest, I might have to let you follow up your Seiko Monster pick with the category, because I'm hoping you pick one of mine so I don't have to pick.
Oh boy.
Between the two, because I've got more than one that I really, there's nothing wrong with them, but it's not going to be for me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right. So, all right, just to lay the groundwork here, I have two kind of general picks in my list, both of which could be used and expanded to a category, and I'm just dying to mention the one of them. So I'm gonna sneak it in later as an honorable mention. But in terms of the category, I'm actually not even gonna go category. I'm gonna go brand.
Oh, okay.
Which I think is a great, great brand. But I don't like a single watch in their collection, and that is Cartier.
Ah, okay.
It's funny. I was having this conversation privately on a direct message chain with Tom Place. Lately, he's been wearing his Calibre de Cartier Diver, which
it's cool.
I had an opportunity to take diving and try out years ago for a couple of weeks. And at the time, it was kind of like the only Cartier that I liked. And it was, you know, for obvious reasons, it was a dive watch. It's a little funky now. I kind of look at it sideways. But I just look up and down their offerings, and I just do not see a single watch that I like. I get why they're popular. I understand the appeal. They're high quality. There's prestige. There's class, there's you know, kind of heritage, but I couldn't wear a single Cartier. And I people have tried, you know, I think this has come up in a past episode, and people have said, oh, the blacked out Santos would, you know, and I'm like, okay, yeah, sort of, but no, I just I'm gonna put Cartier in this if we can call it a category
brand.
But it's a whole brand, actually.
Yeah, look, I really like Cartier. I enjoy the tanks. Occasionally the right era of the Santos on a bracelet when it's not two-tone. I think they're killer. I think they suit a smaller wrist really, really well.
Yeah.
I think their modern stuff is really beautifully made as well. Like, they're making a very high quality product. And when you get the right special for you, they feel really special.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the popularity of, I would say, if I'm allowed to psychoanalyze your pick a little bit.
Yeah.
The popularity of Cartier that's going on right now, that has been on the rise for the last, say, 5 years or so,
mm-hmm.
is a direct response to the sorts of watches that you deeply love.
Yeah. Yeah.
Classic right tool watches, mid-century, mid-century inspired dive watches, and that kind of thing. And I think people found all those watches, or the cohort just above them, were obsessed with these, you know, the Steve McQueen of it all, the Paul Newman of it all, the Cussler of it all. Yeah. And kind of the response was to go towards these much more dressy things from an exceptional name, mm-hmm. Like Cartier. And, yeah. I totally understand that pick for sure.
And I think it comes down to, so much about kind of the way we view watches, or how we, how they reflect who we are. And I think for me, it's just, I've said this before, but I kind of come from this idea that a watch is an extension. It's a piece of gear, like your boots or your skis or whatever. And I realize that nowadays that's not the case necessarily. Mm-hmm. But that's still kind of my ethos. And I think for a Cartier, something you have to, I think you mentioned this, take off your wrist and slip in your shoe and leave it on the dock when you jump in the lake. Like, I don't want that. I want the watch that you can wear, yeah. With your shoes when you jump in the lake, kind of thing,
Yeah. When we transitioned from, Steve McQueen shooting pistols in the desert to Don Draper, having four martinis at lunch, I feel like the taste has kind of shifted that way as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, true. So. Yeah, right.
But yeah, I get that for sure. I'm having a lot of trouble with mine. All right, we're gonna go with ultra deep divers.
Okay. All right. I like this.
I like that they exist. I have no interest in owning one. Mm-hmm. Whether it's the Rolex, the Omega, what was the one from years ago, Jason? It was like a yellow dial, Sector, maybe.
Oh no. Yeah. Oh no. Do you remember
Swiss,
that?
It was like a Swiss something.
Swiss something. Yeah. Right.
It wasn't Swiss Army, but it was
12,000 meters.
Yeah, exactly. Somebody screaming at their screen. Yeah, I think as soon as the watch has to become essentially unwearable for that number,
yeah,
you've lost the plot.
Yeah,
I think that if you have a totally wearable watch that's a 500 meters or 1,000, that's very impressive. That speaks to the engineering of being able to do both, right? But as soon as you get into these ones where the watch is now less of a watch because it can go to a depth that nobody can go to. I just don't know what the point is anymore, and it bugs whatever practical piece is left of me.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I like that they exist, and I was there for the launch of the Deep Sea Challenge, and I got to see the machine they had to make to test it, because it's tested to deeper than any ocean goes.
Yeah.
And I go, but that's equal parts silly and interesting.
Yeah.
From a technological standpoint, okay, cool. I'm on board. From a product standpoint, who's buying this and who's wearing it? I have seen one in the wild, but it was at Quail,
yeah,
which is kind of where you would wear that watch, I guess, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, that's my pick. I had a couple others, but that's the one that I like them and I get it. I think I get it, but I wouldn't buy one.
Yeah, yeah, no.
Like the 200 meters of my Pelagos is plenty.
Yeah.
I mean, most of the watches that I have that are 100 meters, I don't ever consider them to be like out of spec for diving.
Mm-hmm.
As long as it's a screw down crown, because I guess I'm a fuddy duddy that way. But yeah, the deep divers don't speak to me. Have you ever owned one of these ones with like a really big number?
I guess the Supermarine 2000.
1000.
Supermarine 2000. Oh, yeah. I still got that. That's a monster, huge thing. Ploprof. I had a Ploprof, the modern one. Yeah, I guess I've had some deep ones. I had the 1000 meter Citizen, professional diver a few years ago. I mean, they're fun, but yeah, they're kind of largely, the trade-off in kind of lack of wearability versus, function is just kind of, it tips the scales a little too far in one direction. So, and I just Googled that watch that we were both thinking of. It's the CX Swiss Military.
CX Swiss Military. There
the,
it is.
With
thank
the
you.
Yellow
that
dial.
That was going to bother me for a while.
Yellow dial, just massive thing. Yeah, 12,000 feet. Anyway, so glad we solved that one. All right.
Yeah, good stuff. So that's our three picks each and our whole category. I'm sure this will kick off as some sort of an interesting conversation in the Slack. So preempting some of that, any sort of honorable mentions, like ones that you didn't want to, they didn't have to make the list, but were on your mind when you were putting the list together?
Yeah, actually, this was the first one that came to mind. Like when we initially proposed this topic, I was like, yep, I know exactly which one's coming first. But it kind of breaks the bank. It's a more expensive luxury piece. And this is also one that could straddle into the category kind of pick. And this is the Chopard Alpine Eagle. Sure. 41 millimeter. Just not my taste. And I feel like I've seen so much praise for this watch. I know you've liked it. It's come up.
I like the 36 a lot.
Several times. Yeah. And it doesn't have to be the 41. There's just, I'm not a fan of Roman numerals on dials for one thing. And
sure.
I almost, as I was considering this, I was thinking to myself, do I actually not like integrated bracelet steel sports watches in general? And so that's why.
All right, so that was the other category. It could be the other category. Ultra deep divers.
Yeah.
I don't think I care.
Oh yeah. Right.
I get why they're popular. But like if we're breaking through the walls here, if I was a Patek guy, I would have an Aquanaut on a rubber strap.
Yeah. Same. Yeah.
The fitted bracelet, the Royal Oak of it all, the this or that, maybe the exception would be a Cardinal Points.
Yeah. Yeah.
If I could be that guy.
Yeah.
It's really good on the bracelet, right? But from the Tissot PRX to that new Raymond wheel to the Chopard, like I like the Chopard. It's a nicely made watch. The 36 millimeter fits really well when I wear it, but I don't think I'm pining after it. And I think as the category has become like a playbook for brands of any price point, each one makes it a percent less interesting to me.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. That's my honorable mention / category.
And I like a NATO. I feel like I might be on record about preferring a NATO.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You know, nearly 400 episodes in here. But yeah, any others stand out for you?
No, that was my list. Yeah. G-Shock was the one that you got before I got there. But yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my other ones were like chronographs that are so insanely popular. Speedmaster, Daytona.
Mm, yeah.
Like, there's no argument on the planet to say, like, this is a bad watch.
Yeah.
That's insane. But, like, I don't really understand the love.
Yeah.
You know, none of them feel great on my wrist. You know, a lot of them I find difficult to read or borderline, like, illegible from a time. Not just the sub counters, but sometimes the time as well.
Yeah.
Depending on the colorway and the rest of it. I guess I'm just that much of like a kind of dive or travel watch guy that like I'm super picky when it comes to chronographs. And the ones I like a lot.
Yeah.
But the hype around the Daytona and just kind of it being, again, just kind of like a playbook for people who have a certain amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
I just, that doesn't always rub me the right way. Obviously they're beloved by collectors. So that's not the problem.
Yeah.
But yeah, has never really done it for me. I mean, if I wanted to softball my category, I could say two-tone watches, don't like those. Mm-hmm. Gilt watches, don't like those. But that's not interesting. We've been talking about that for years. So
yeah
ultra deep divers felt like more of a surprise.
But, no, that's a good.
That was fun. That's a fun little pick. Draft. Yeah, thanks really to fun. Dave N for the idea.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, I think the rest of this conversation can happen on the Slack.
Yeah.
I think there'll be lots of opinions, both for and against our picks. But Jason, you picked the Rolex Explorer, the Grand Seiko UFA Spring Drive Diver, Seiko Monster, and Cartier watches as a whole. In terms of your category, you went for a brand. Brave picks, I'd say, for the most part.
Yeah, same. I think
Seiko Monster stings a little bit.
I thought it might, yeah. Yeah, you went with the G-Shock 5600, the Breitling Emergency, the Omega Seamaster 300-meter diver, and your category was ultra-deep divers. So good stuff.
But with that in mind, like I said, a big shout out to Dave N for the great question. We'll get to more Slack Q&A in the future. But for now, how about a little bit of final notes?
Yeah, sure. Mine is it's a bit of an older pick. I guess it's from early July. And it's on YouTube. And it's a video called, I hate this title, Why Americans Pay $170,000 for This British SUV. And it comes from the Wall Street Journal's style section. They've got a series called Coveted. And as you might guess from the title, it's about Land Rovers. And it says here, the Wall Street Journal explains why the classic, quote unquote, British Jeep has surged in popularity and why they can sell for up to $170,000 in the U.S. So, you know, this isn't a big surprise. There isn't, much surprise in this video, but it's kind of a fun look at the variety and kind of love of old Land Rovers, of which I'm one of its proponents. And there's some kind of familiar faces and organizations in here. You know, Brooklyn Coachworks is in here, kind of a well-known New York Land Rover refurbisher. There's a woman from Instagram that is in here as well that people might recognize, and just kind of covers a broad range of kind of the love of old Land Rovers and why they're still very popular. And I just, you know, if you're like me and you just kind of like to watch them driving around and people talking about old Land Rovers, I think this is a good video.
Yeah, I didn't realize yours were each worth $170,000.
Yeah. That's impressive. Gee, I should just retire now. I'm just sitting on a gold mine here. Yeah.
Good nest egg.
Right. Well. Yeah, that's just such an absurd.
It's probably that new top that pushed it to $170,000. Right. It might even be $180,000.
Yeah.
Who knows? Yeah, this is great. I do enjoy the coveted series, as do my daughters, when we're sitting down and kind of watching shorter stuff like the Business Insider does, like, why is this so expensive?
Yeah.
And takes you like into its supply chains, and that's it's fascinating stuff. So these could be great, and I'm excited to watch that. Yeah. Good pick.
All right, what do you got?
This week I have a follow up to a book I recommended last year or even earlier this year. I didn't read it that long ago, which was Nuclear War: A Scenario by Annie Jacobson. Annie, or Miss Jacobson, has followed that up with a new one called Biological War: A Scenario, and it is, again, jaw dropping.
Yeah.
Oh, totally terrifying. This just came out, I believe, just recently, and I missed its announcement, and hadn't like signed up for the wait list on my Kindle, but I was hanging out with my brothers while I was off, and my brother Grant said he bought it the day it came out and read it that weekend, and I'm doing the same. These are jaw-dropping books. The Nuclear War one was an incredible thing to read, and I know I rambled on about it on a previous episode, but I recommend either of these. The Biological War one is a whole different, obviously a different category and a different type of terror, and having the hindsight of COVID behind us, it's even kind of scarier. So I, if it's something that feels interesting to you, maybe go grab the. It's definitely a book where in a chapter you're gonna understand the vibe. The tone is equal throughout.
Mm, yeah.
You can go grab the Kindle sample if you're not sure. It was easily worth the $18 that I paid, and I hope Annie gets a decent cut of that. She's just become and anything she writes, I will be reading. And anytime she pops up on a podcast, I will listen. So I'm a big fan of this one. It's absolutely terrifying. Very dark. Mm. Very, very dark.
Yeah.
But a great read.
Yeah. Yeah. Good pick. Well, we came in under an hour, just barely.
Look at us.
Yeah, right.
It's that August energy.
Right. Yeah. Efficiency. Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. Well, as always, thanks so much for listening. If you want to subscribe to the show notes, get into the comments for each episode, or consider supporting the show directly, and maybe even grab a new TGN signed NATO, please visit thegraynato.com. Music throughout A Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we leave you with this quote from Mel Brooks, who I believe recently celebrated his 100th birthday, who said, "Bad taste is simply saying the truth before it should be said."